You're listening to the Newsmakers podcast from MLB.com.
This is the Rocket, Bill Lightson. Welcome to Newsmakers. We have a lot going on today. First, we pay tribute to Roy Halladay, who passed away this week. We talked to Richard Justice, former teammate Scott Downs, and Phillies beat writer Todd Zielecki about Halladay's greatness on the mound. We then shift gears and talk to World Series hero Brad Peacock, and then we talk to baseball author Mark Newman. We start with Richard Justice, who believes Roy Halladay is a Hall of Famer. Enjoy the podcast. On the phone is MLB.com columnist Richard Justice. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. Richard, we got to start off on a sad note. Roy Halladay, he passed away yesterday in a plane crash. So devastating. And, you know, talk about the great pitcher he was.
Yeah, you know, I think you're probably the same way. I'm really not to the grieving stage yet because I can't get my mind around the fact that he's gone. You know, he's only, I saw him in spring training in 2013, and he hadn't reached, he's a year away from Hall of Fame eligibility, mm-hmm. so we hadn't started considering his career in that way. He had an amazing life to be 40 years old, Bill. He was in the big leagues at 21, looked like he was a failure at 23. He and Mel Queen reinvented himself. He became an 8-time All-Star, 7 times top five in Cy Young voting. I mean, to me, a slam dunk Hall of Famer. But, you know, today, Chris Carpenter and Jimmy Rollins and all those guys, that's not what they're remembering. They're remembering a guy that just had such a huge heart. He was a good teammate. He wouldn't leave the dugout because he believed that's how you supported your teammates. He was coaching youth baseball. You could tell he absolutely loved it. He did all kinds of work with underprivileged kids. When he retired, he said, "My goal was to leave the game better than I found it." Mm-hmm. And in terms of what he did, in terms of using his fame to help others, in terms of being a great competitor, he did that. One of the things that made him great was, players would show up at spring training at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he would have already gone through a full workout. But the other part of that was, he kept the game really simple. He didn't think about pitching 7 innings, or allowing 2 runs or less or anything. He just kept it. He believed that you execute the next pitch, that pitch. And then you do good thing after good thing after good thing, and it adds up. And he mentored. I always thought he and Chris Carpenter was mentored when they were younger by Roger Clemens. They brushed up against each other as teammates and in spring training.
Right.
And I think he got some of Clemens' fire. And he passed that down to Cole Hamels. But beyond that, you know, and just stuff he did, like buying a cop canine for the Tarpon Springs Police Sheriff's Department and all of that. He's just a good guy, and you could go, I mean, it's heartbreaking to go through his Twitter feed and just see he loved that airplane, he loved the life he was leading, he loved his kids he was coaching, he had a good sense of humor and all of that. I think when we first learned there'd been a plane crash and the plane was in Halladay's name, you think, this just can't be. And Bill, I can't even imagine the hole in Chris Carpenter's heart today, and lots of other people he touched, because baseball teams are like families, and you're with them more than your family, and you bond with them. So that's it. You know, the baseball part of it is easy. He was a great player. He was between 2001 and 2012. I mean, he was second in ERA, WHIP, all those things. I mean, he was among the best in baseball. In those 11 years, he threw 64 complete games. Nobody else in baseball had more than 34. So that's his legacy. He left, I guess the ultimate compliment to a man is that he leaves a legacy that's both professional and personal, and people that knew him, competed against him, had the highest regard. I saw Andrew McCutchen remembered one of the times he faced him and went, "Oh, so that's what a cutter is supposed to look like."
And, right.
You know, there are lots of people remembering him for that and other stuff today.
Richard, I mean, what impresses me when I look at his stats, I look at 266 innings pitched 1 year, another year, 250 innings. I mean, do you think we'll ever see that again?
I don't want to say never, you know, because when you see Kershaw and Scherzer and those guys, they pride themselves on taking the ball, and Verlander taking the ball and not giving it back. 0-1-11, second in the majors in wins, whip, and ERA, you know, seven times top five Cy Young. He just perfected the art. He could put the ball where he wanted to do it, and he was blessed with a great fastball. And again, he had to reinvent himself at 23 years old. Mel Queen helped him with that and all. 2009 All-Star game in St. Louis, he was being rushed off the podium, you know, where he's announced as a starting pitcher into a live ESPN shot, and he runs upon our friend Bob Elliott, who covered him from the beginning.
Right.
And they're like, hey, we got a live shot here, and he sees that Bob Elliott needs him and wants to ask him a question apart from the podium. And they're like rushing him through, and he goes, no, I got to take care of my guy here. And that's sort of the way I think a lot of people are feeling that today, that he was a guy that always wanted to do the right thing and beyond that, was a great player.
And what's amazing to me, you mentioned this earlier, he went all the way down to Class A Dunedin to, you know, straighten his mechanics, and he was straightened out by Mel Queen, as you mentioned.
Right.
I mean, most people, their careers would have been over once that happened, but somehow this guy found a way to get back to the big leagues and flourish.
Yeah, and I remember his last spring training with the Phillies. You know, his shoulder, 3,000 innings, his shoulder was worn out. And he was still trying, you know. And he's just one of those guys that just believed, I'll work a little harder, I'll do this a little more. And he was pitching against, I think it was Pittsburgh minor leaguers, and just monkeying with his delivery and all kinds of things. He's a guy that always thought the mental side of it was important as the physical side of it. And wow, I mean, you can cover this game a long time and not go through a guy that made the impact on people that he did. And we haven't even talked about the fact that he threw the second no-hitter in postseason history.
That's right.
That he pitched the 20th perfect game in history. And those are days like, and you see this occasionally, where the other team is not mad. I mean, the Reds, what they tell you about the Reds, you know, in the Reds clubhouse that day, they're like, forget it. It was his day, and he was not going to lose. He was just he was blessed. And it's what's so sad is, you know, is leaving behind the family. But he had so much of life to go. He was working with the Phillies and I think another team, maybe the Blue Jays too. It's kind of a mental coach, and boy, he leaves a hole in a lot of hearts today.
And he also showed how much he loved the Blue Jays, even though most of his fame came in Philadelphia.
Right.
I mean, he signed his last baseball contract. It was a one-day contract with the Toronto Blue Jays. So in his heart, he was always a Blue Jay. So
yeah,
that tells
you
something.
Right. And Jason Stark had a great line on that. Like, their record with him pitching was something like 100 over, and their record with anybody else pitching was 40 under. And he made the difficult decision, and he made a lot of money, but he left money on the table because he wanted to go to Philly because that was a made-for-winning team,
right.
And he wanted to go there. And he wrote a letter to the fans of Toronto saying, I love it here. I love this city. I hope you understand why I did this.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Phillies at that time, you know, finished first 5 years in a row, and they sort of they had those guys like Rollins and Utley were like him. In that they sort of were like, they strapped it on every day and played, and he wanted to be part of that. And he got to, you know, first postseason start, he throws a no-hitter. So that's his legacy, you know. And I know I was communicating with our colleague Allison Footer yesterday when it became clear that there was a plane crash and he might be involved. And I remember feeling this on the day that Mike Flanagan died. Something had happened at Mike Flanagan's house, the great Orioles pitcher.
Right.
And you've got this 10 or 15 minutes where you're just praying to God, don't let this be. Just don't let this be. And you almost want to turn off your phone and make it go away.
Right.
Do not let this be Roy Halladay.
Yeah.
And because he was a special person.
No question about it. No question. One more thing. The managerial spots have been filled for the most part, with the exception of the Yankees. And I'd like to know, what do you think, who could be the manager for the Yankees? Everyone is talking David Cone, Raul Ibanez. It could be anybody.
You know what? I know who they want. They want the A.J. Hinch blueprint. They want a guy. Well, A.J. Hinch failed, you know, in Arizona. I don't know that failed is the right word, but he didn't succeed in parts of two seasons, and he was fired. And a lot of people didn't think he was going to get another job, and one of the things he learned is how to relate to players. But that's who they want. They want that blueprint, 40-something, collaborate, manage up, collaborate with the front office on the data, relate to the players. I always thought, you know, you and I, you don't really know, we're not in there, but I always thought Joe Girardi did a good job relating to players, you know, because I think those kids, Judge and Sanchez, and I thought they seem to have a respect for him. But Bill, we're in an era now where you have a mountain of information. So everybody's going to have the same information. It's how you utilize it, and it's how you relate to the players and allow them to relate to you. And so if that's Robbie Thompson, you know, I've heard Al Padrique's name mentioned. I think he's been hired someplace else then. You know, I don't know. It's a tough decision. And it's a big decision for Brian Cashman in that you're judged by the people you surround yourself with.
Right, no doubt about it. Of all the managerial hires that you've heard this offseason, which one impresses you the most?
Oh, I'm close to Alex Cora, and I love his resume. The fact that he played for Davey, he played for Jim Tracy, he played for Tito. He was a GM for the Puerto Rican team of the World Baseball Classic. Mm-hmm. He was a manager down there, and he fired himself as manager. He's gotten that out of the way. And the game was hard for Alex and his brother Joey. The game was hard. And I think when the game is hard for you, I think you're more sympathetic to players. And I think you're more understanding of what it's like to play.
Right.
Gabe Kapler's an interesting one. I mean, there are people who think this is one of the great hires ever. He's a very smart guy, great communicator. But he has, through the years, had some unconventional thoughts about things. You know, we'll see. A lot of it is, you're only as good as your top three starting pitchers.
That's correct. Yes, it's the talent you have, no doubt. Richard, listen, thank you so much for being on the show. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Bill.
My next guest is former big leaguer Scott Downs, who played with Roy Halladay for 5 years in Toronto. Halladay taught Downs a lot about pitching. Here's what Downs had to say. On the phone is Scott Downs, former major leaguer Scott Downs, and he was a teammate of Roy Halladay from 2005 to 2009. They were both with the Toronto Blue Jays. Scott, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate it.
Scott, you know, this is a sad occasion here, and talk about how shocked you were when you heard the news. Did you know Roy Halladay was into flying planes?
Well, I knew he had talked about it, you know, playing with him. You know, it was one of those things where when he was playing in New England, he'd always talked about flying and how excited it would be to be able to have, you know, to be a pilot. And, he got to live that dream. And unfortunately, we're talking about him not being here today.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, you were with him in Toronto. What kind of person and teammate was he?
Oh, I don't know if we have enough time in the day to talk about that.
We have some
one
time.
Of those guys where, he's going to be the first one to the field. He's going to be the last one to leave. And he's there. He's always there for you. If you want to talk, if you need to learn about something, if you wanted to just prep on anything with video, just you want to talk about family. I mean, they can go on and on and on. I had an instance with him. It was in 2007. It was spring training. And I told him, I said, one of these days I'm going to beat you to the field for spring training.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said, no, you can't do it. Well, one day I showed up at 5 and he was pulling in the park lot. So I had beaten him, and that was the last time that I had beaten him to the field. He was showing up at 4:30, 5 o'clock every day. So, he's the one that inspired my work ethic. And, you know, I think for a lot of other work ethics. So, I mean, my career is based on what I, you know, learned and learned from Roy and watched him do.
Now, you improved. I remember I covered you in Montreal, and when you went to Toronto, you became a quality relief pitcher. What did you learn from him from a pitching standpoint? What was the biggest thing you learned?
Just how to attack hitters and just how to find weaknesses. Doc was, as soon as his previous start was over, he was in the video preparing for his next start 5 days later. There was no grace period for him. He enjoyed the moment for a little bit, and then it was back to work. And I think watching that and learning how to handle, you know, how to handle yourself as a pitcher, you learn the parts of the game that people really don't see, the ins and outs, that what it takes to stay in shape, what it takes to just prepare day in and day out. And I, you know, in talking with him over the, you know, the tough times of pitching, when, you know, when it wasn't fun, when you've blown a couple saves or when you've had a couple losses, it's, you know, that's where you learn the most. And I think that's where he inspired guys so much, because he took it upon himself to either end a losing streak or stop something bad that was going to happen, whether it was personally or as a team.
Now, he played for Toronto for quite a few years. And how much did he love Toronto? The reason why I'm asking is because I remember his last day in Major League Baseball, he signed a one-day contract with Toronto. Mm-hmm. And how much did he love Toronto?
Well, that says it right there. I mean, he's a Blue Jay in heart always, even when he was traded to Philly. He wanted that chance to win. You know, he wanted to have that opportunity to win a World Series. And he knew at the time that Toronto wasn't going to be at that point where he was, and Doc getting at his point in his career and wanted to win. And so, I mean, he got the chance to go to Philly, but like you said, he came straight back and signed a big contract with Toronto because that's where his heart is. And you know, that's a home away from home for him. That was his family. And like I said, the city of Toronto right now is missing a great competitor, that's for sure.
No question about it. You think he's a Hall of Famer?
100%. 100%.
What was the thing that impressed you, you know, when you look at the stats, you look at all those innings pitched, all the wins. What impressed you the most?
It wasn't really about the wins, losses. You just knew. I mean, you knew every fifth day there was a good chance as a bullpen you weren't going to pitch. You know, and that nowadays, that, you know, that's not happening anymore. I mean, starters go 5, 6, maybe 7 innings, but when Doc was on the mound, you knew that the game was over. You knew there was a good chance you weren't going to pitch. And I remember we had a game. We were playing the Yankees, and Johnny Damon was in left field. This was, I think, in 07 or 08 maybe. Mm-hmm. Damon's in left field, and he, after the whole half inning, he comes out to left field, looks in the bullpen to me, and says, "Don't worry about it, y'all. I'm gonna have to pitch today." That's how Doc was, you know, and that's how the opponents felt too. I mean, they knew when he stepped on the mound, there was a chance that he was gonna dominate, and that's just it's just one of those things that, you know, that you admire, and that's what helps him with young guys trying to inspire to be like him. I think as a generational pitcher, you're not going to find another one of that that's going to compete like that.
Yeah, no question about it. I want to ask you this too. When it came to, he was once sent to the minor leagues to Class A Dunedin. This is before you came along.
Right.
What does that tell you? I mean, he went all the way down there and got his confidence back and became a great pitcher. What does that say?
How bad he wanted, you know, how bad he liked to compete and how hard he wanted to push himself to get to be at the top of the game. And he didn't want to be, you know, he didn't need the praise. He just wanted to put in the work. And it just, his work ethic, like I said, is second to none. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a guy that's, you know, been in the big leagues for a little bit to get Sam the A-ball, that can kick you, you know, in the shorts a little bit mentally. But, you know, he didn't handle things like that. He liked the challenge, and he accepted that challenge. And you know, he became, you know, one of the greatest of all time at what he did.
No doubt about it. Scott Downs, listen, thank you so much for helping us remember Roy Halladay. And,
no problem, Bill. Thank you for having me. And, you know, like I said earlier, the baseball world has lost a great man and good friend, good teammate, and good everything else. So I appreciate that you had me on to talk about him a little bit.
You got it. Thank you so much, Scott. Todd Zielecki covered Roy Halladay for 4 years when Halladay played for the Philadelphia Phillies. You get the impression Todd enjoyed having a front row seat watching Halladay on the mound. On the phone is Phillies beat writer Todd Zielecki. He covers the Phillies for MLB.com. Todd, thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Todd, I'm talking to you on a sad time. Roy Halladay. He passed away yesterday. And tell me the type of person and pitcher he was.
You know, he was a great person and obviously a great pitcher. You know, obviously I've been thinking a lot about Roy over the last 24 hours since the news broke. And what really kind of sticks out in my mind is, you know, he was the first Phillies player I covered that really kind of had a huge presence about him. And I say that because I started covering the Phillies in 2003. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, in a sense, came up with Jimmy Rounds and Chase Utley and Ryan Howard and Cole Hamels. You know, like Jimmy, J-Roll was only in the big leagues since 2000. So he was still pretty young. Chase's first year was 2003. Ryan Howard made a brief appearance in September 2004. You know, Cole, you know, a year or two later. So I almost kind of looked at them like, I don't know, I kind of grew up with them in the sense of the beat. But when Roy Halladay joined the Phillies in December of 2009, I just remember that first spring training in the following year in 2010, seeing him in the clubhouse, just walk through the clubhouse, it was kind of like a, whoa, that's Roy Halladay right there. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I only felt that way really once. One other time in my career, when I first got started reporting and writing, I was at a very small paper outside of Chicago, and I got to cover a Bulls practice one day, and they had the media kind of in the separate room before practice ended, and these kind of like blinds, just automatic blinds, rose from the ground up, and there was Michael Jordan about 5 feet away from me, but behind this glass shooting free throws. I'm like, oh, my God. That's Michael Jordan. And I felt the same way when I saw Roy Halladay kind of walk through. It was like, wow, the Phillies actually have Roy Halladay. And then to watch him pitch, you still felt that same way. Just seeing him throughout go through the clubhouse throughout the year, you still, every time you saw him, I was like, wow, that's Roy Halladay right there. Like, he's on his way to do some sort of workout, or he's on his way to watch film, or he's, you know, this guy was a man really serious about his job, everything that he did seriously. But on the other hand, he could be very introspective about his pitching performances. You know, he was kind of like a reluctant superstar, but he was a professional as well. So, you know, after he's pitched, he would sit there and he'd talk to you for 10, 15 minutes and really kind of break down his start and what he felt about it. And, you know, but you also saw over time, you know, he had a great sense of humor. You know, he could kind of joke around with some people, and he could have fun with himself and with others. And but overall, I mean, just a really tremendous athlete, tremendous person. You know, he really did love his family. You know, he really truly enjoyed coaching his kids. I mean, everything that you've heard and read in the past 24 hours is absolutely true about him.
To show how much the Phillies loved him, what was your reaction when you saw Cole Hamels in the press conference in Philadelphia?
Well, I'll tell you what, that to me said a lot about how much Roy meant to these players, you know. Cole still has a home here. He lives here in the off season, but the fact that he's like, I mean, he basically said, you know, told the Phillies, do you want me to come down and talk? I'd be happy to come down and talk, you know, because it was a huge situation. You know, he didn't have to do that, but Roy really kind of touched a lot of these people's lives, and really, you know, the Phillies didn't win a World Series with Roy Halladay, but you know, people are going to look back at those couple of years, 2010, 2011, when they won the NL East and had the best record in baseball, and they, you know, Roy Halladay is really kind of like the guy that pushed them over the top in terms of being like the absolute undisputed dominant team in Major League Baseball. But yeah, like just to see Cole there, I think that really showed you as well, like you said, you know, how much he meant to people. Because people definitely wanted to make sure that they expressed their gratitude and expressed their feelings about Roy Halladay and what he meant to them.
Do you think he's a Hall of Famer and why?
I do think he's a Hall of Famer. And I know everybody has different criteria, but here's why I think he's a Hall of Famer. I think he was one of the best pitchers of his generation. Mm-hmm. You know, in that 10, there's a 10-12 year span there where he was, if not the best starting pitcher in Major League Baseball, he was right up at the very, very top. And in an era where, you know, not a lot of guys complete games anymore, he completed a ton. You know, I read something in that. This stat isn't totally accurate, but I'm in the ballpark. He had, like, say, 67 complete games or whatever the number was.
Right.
Like, there are teams that haven't had that many complete games, you know, this decade. You know, and for me, a starting pitcher's value, a lot of it comes down to how deep can this guy pitch into a game. You know, you get through that lineup that third, fourth time, and you're still dealing, and you can do it on a consistent basis. And that's a huge thing for a rotation, for a team, for a bullpen, and he could do that better than anybody else that pitched in his era. And so for that reason, you know, I do think he's a Hall of Famer. I hope he gets in, and I hope people don't go, well, you know, he only won 200 plus games. You know, I mean, you got to look at everything else that happened that you judge pitchers by. And I'm hoping that voters down the road will consider those things and put him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, look at those innings pitched. I mean, all those innings he pitched, not just for the Phillies but for Toronto as well. I mean, that's amazing. You don't see that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I had a Cy Young vote, NL Cy Young vote last year, and you know, one of the first things I looked at was innings pitched. You know, Max Scherzer Max Scherzer last year was an obvious choice, you know, but one of the reasons why I voted for him with the first place vote is because he pitched a ton of innings. He pitched deep into the game regularly, and it's a lot easier to get out of a game allowing, you know, one run in five or six innings, but it's a heck of a lot harder to allow one run in seven, eight, nine innings, and Roy Halladay did that with regularity.
Talk about what he went through his last couple of years in the big leagues. I know he had a bad shoulder, and obviously pitching all those innings caught up with him. Could you talk about what it was like those last 2 years?
It was kind of sad to watch him decline. You know, he had some shoulder issues. He had some back issues. You know, Michael Young, who was with the Phillies in 2013, tweeted out a great anecdote last night saying, you know, it was in August, I think, of 2013. The Phillies were pitching at Wrigley Field. Roy was really struggling. He couldn't locate the ball. And Michael Young went out to the mound, and Roy just looked at him and said, "Everything hurts." But he did not want to come out of the game. He was not going to ask out of the game because he was kind of a warrior. And that's, you know, that's the kind of approach he took to it. He never really played up those injuries. He kind of always downplayed them. You know, kind of like Chase Utley would with the Phillies. He never wanted to acknowledge that he was hurt. But it was kind of sad to see him decline because, you know, again, he was the best guy, you know, the best pitcher in baseball, and so absolutely dominant for years and years and years. And now he's going out there, and he just could not do what he once could do. And, you know, you're sitting there, you know, it's kind of like just like the aging warrior, you know, you're sitting there going, "Oh man, I remember what it used to be like," and it was tough to watch. And I'm kind of glad he ended up walking away when he did, rather than try to grind out another year and recapture some magic that he wouldn't be able to recapture. But thankfully, he had way more good years than he had those last couple of years.
Now, from all the reports I've read and heard, I understand he was in the analytics. Was he really in the analytics?
Well, he was in the sense that he, you know, he really studied a lot before the game. You know, he put in a tremendous amount of preparation. Nobody outworked him, and nobody could out-prepare him. You know, like, so he really studied hitters. He kept track of, you know, how he had done against previous batters throughout the course of his career. He had a really good memory in terms of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I do remember, before starts, he would be staring at it, going through his iPad or going through notebooks or whatever, and kind of just, trying to get every piece of information he could have. So if he got into a certain situation, he would be prepared to pitch in that situation. So I guess, whatever you want to call it, analytics. I mean, there was a lot of analytics involved. He was definitely one of those guys that was on board with it.
Final question, Todd. Knowing Roy Halladay as you do, what was the biggest thing you learned from him?
The biggest thing I learned from him is just the tremendous amount of will that it takes to be great, just the tremendous amount of work that it takes to be great. I mean, he wanted to be great, and so he made it happen. And obviously, he had a tremendous amount of talent. He was a first-round pick back in the day by the Blue Jays, but he was getting absolutely crushed his second year in the big leagues. He had an ERA of over 10, which is still like the highest ever ERA by a pitcher, like with I think over a certain amount of innings, like over 100 innings in the season, it was over 10. Mm-hmm. He got sent all the way back down to Class A, Dunedin. I mean, think about that, right? Like,
yes.
He had a really good first year. It was terrible the second year. Now this guy's pitching in Class A. It's like, hello, first round bust, you know? But he said, you know what? I'm going to work through this. He changed his entire delivery. He really took to sports psychology. He became a disciple of Harvey Dorfman. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, I'm going to make myself a great pitcher. And he did. And then once he got to that level, he says, I'm going to maintain it. And that's why he was infamous for these, 7 a.m. workouts and getting to spring training at like 5:30. And guys would be rolling in to get breakfast, and he'd be finishing up breakfast with a workout thrown in before that. So that's the thing that stands out to me when I think about Roy Halladay more than anything else, just the tremendous work ethic and the will to be the best.
Todd Zielecki, listen, thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for helping us remember Roy Halladay.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care. My next guest is Astros pitcher Brad Peacock. He still can't believe he's a World Series hero. On the phone is a World Series hero. His name is Brad Peacock of the Houston Astros. Brad, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, no problem at all, man.
Brad, has it hit you yet? You're a member of the world champion Houston Astros. Has that hit you yet?
Yeah, it kind of has, actually.
Tell me.
It kind of has, man. It's crazy.
Tell me how that feeling is.
It's a dream come true. You know, it's what you dream of, as a little kid growing up. And, it came true the other night. It was crazy.
What has the last few weeks been like for you? I know it's been crazy.
Yeah, just, I got home a couple of days ago, just been relaxing and just hanging out. And, nothing too crazy, just back to my normal self, for sure.
Wow. Your highlight was Game 3 of the World Series, and it was a 5-3 victory. And you pitched the last 3 2/3 of shutout ball. But not only that, you picked up your first save. And
yeah.
Tell me how special that was, and did you expect to pitch that long?
Tell you the truth, I did not. Because, the first inning, I gave up some Atlantis runs. And, I thought maybe I had one more. And, I just kept doing well. And they just kept asking how I felt. And I kept telling them good. And then the ninth inning came, and he asked me how I felt again, and didn't say it was out of the game, so I knew it was getting the ninth, and it was pretty cool. I haven't closed the game since junior college.
That's amazing. When I saw you after that game, now maybe I'm wrong when I say this, but I thought you were getting emotional, that you couldn't believe what you had just done.
I was in shock, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
how I felt.
tell me about that, because I thought you were going to cry. Really?
I mean, maybe. It was just, I don't know, just all the memories from the past couple seasons. I haven't been very good, and just to, get a save in the World Series, it just meant a lot to me. It's crazy.
And I know, I also know your father, and I know he must have been proud. Talk about what it meant to your father.
Oh, man. I think he was in more shock than I was. He was very happy. I mean, just for him to be there, and it was a good experience for him. And, since he's been traveling around watching me play, and for him to see me play in the World Series, man, it meant a lot to him, for sure.
I can imagine. Now, not only did you have a great World Series, it was a breakout year for you. 13-2, 3.00 ERA. What was the turning point this year? Why was this year a breakout year?
Just tell the truth, man, just being healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the past couple of years, I wasn't pitching healthy, and I knew I had to get some stuff taken care of, so I finally did. And you know, I had a normal off season this past off season before this year, and was able to work out normally. And I think that's just the key. Just, I got stronger, and you know, I added a couple of new pitches and just tweaked my arm slot a little bit, and that was it, man.
Now, what'd you fix in terms of your health? What did you fix?
Oh, I had hip surgery in 15, and then back surgery in 16, after the 15 season.
Wow.
So 14 hip surgery, 15 back surgery is what it was.
Wow. So, and the thing was, you were out of options, and there was talk of maybe the Astros letting you go before the opening day, but you really proved your worth, and it had to be your happiest in all of baseball.
Absolutely, man. Tell the truth, I made the team because one of my teammates got hurt towards the end of spring training, and that opened up a spot for the long man, and you know, I was so excited just to be into the long man pitching in the big leagues, and then they gave me the opportunity to start and mm-hmm. train with it. And, you know, I couldn't be happier.
Now, the big question is now for next year, you know, are you a starter or are you a reliever? Because I think you proved that you can do both big time.
It's whatever the team wants me to do, man. I'm just happy to live out my dream pitching, you know, pitching in the big leagues, and that's all I care about.
Talk about how much A.J. Hinch really helped you.
I mean, I think he was one of the biggest helps, you know, I had. Just, you know, him having trust in me, for me to start games for a first-place team, that just gave me confidence, you know. And then Strami definitely helping me out big time over the past couple of years. And finally it all coming together, I think that's, you know, what helped me out big time. And
wow.
I can't thank them enough, for sure.
What do you want to do better next year? Obviously, you had a great year this year. Obviously, you want to improve on some things. What do you want to do?
Absolutely. Just pitching a little deeper in the games, you know, trying to get in seventh inning, eighth inning, that'd be real nice. Just pitching deeper, and well, if I'm a starter, yes, pitching deeper. And then if I'm a reliever, just whatever they ask me to do, you know,
right.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you in terms of the Astros, when did you guys realize, hey, you know what, we're a good team and we can go all the way? What'd you think?
In spring training, man, just seeing everybody getting along and just knowing the kind of guys we had on our team. We have some studs like Correa and Springer and Bregman, just all them guys, you know, coming together. And just, it was incredible what they did this year. You know, it was fun to watch all year.
Right. Looking at your career, I remember when you first made your major league debut with the Washington Nationals, which was a great outing. And then you started to get traded. Tell me the feeling you had about your career prior to 2017. It seemed like you were bouncing around quite a bit. Talk about the frustration you faced.
Yeah, the first time I got traded, you know, I didn't know what to think. You know, it was kind of surprised. You know, it was hard leaving all them guys that, you know, was comfortable with, all the coaches over there, like Paul Manhart and all them guys, Bobby Henley. Mm-hmm. You know, it was tough for me to leave those guys because, you know, they're the ones that kind of taught me a lot, and I got along with those guys. And but after the second time I got traded to Houston, I knew there was opportunity here, and I got a lot of it. I got a lot of opportunity, more than I thought I was going to get, and pretty thankful for that. So I was pretty happy to come over here to Houston, for sure.
Brad Teacock, listen, thank you so much for being on the show, and we hope to have you back soon.
I appreciate it, man. No problem. Anytime.
My final guest is MLB.com's Mark Newman. He has a great book out called Diamonds from the Dugout. Here's what he had to say.
On the phone is Mark Newman. He's an enterprise editor for MLB.com. He has a new book out. It's a great book. Everyone should be buying it. It's called Diamonds to the Dugout, and it's put out by Cardinals Publishers Group. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show.
Always glad to talk to you, my friend.
Now, Mark, you asked one question to a lot of ball players, and that was, what hit meant the most to you and why? And you received different answers, mostly motivational lessons and life lessons, and could you talk about what you tried to accomplish in this book?
Sure. It was pretty much unexpected. It started about 10 years ago, Bill, the 2007 Hall of Fame induction weekend. And just an incredible moment in baseball history where Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn were both enshrined, and they smashed attendance records. And it was a real feel-good weekend, and I just remember I was covering it for us at MLB.com that weekend. And I remember after the day after the induction, it was Monday, I'm still there, and I'm in the Hall of Fame Research Library, and I was just pouring over some files, just looking at different hits in baseball history, an Abraham Lincoln file, odds and ends. And first of all, I thought, well, I'm going to maybe put together a book, call it 3,000 hits like these guys, and just start compiling them. I'm glad I didn't do that because it would have taken a lot of space, taken a long time. But what I did over the course is I was compiling just different types of hits in that first year. I just by chance meeting with Brooks Robinson through the course of my own access with MLB.com. You know, when you're not after you've done interviews, you have that downtime. And I tell him, you know, what I was working on, a little project. And he said, oh, let me tell you about a hit that really mattered to me. And it was the story he told me about his first hit in 1955 with the Orioles. And he said, you know, he went 2-for-4 off Chuck Staub's that day. And he's called his parents back in Arkansas, and he said, you know, I'm 18 years old, and I don't even know why they sent me to York from the minors. I should have just been here all along in Baltimore. And he felt, you know, he's this hotshot kid out of Arkansas, felt like he really belonged. And then he proceeded to go 0-for-18. And he's told me that it was a real lesson in humility that really actually served him well in the course of his career and his life. And I know there are a lot of players like that who really had similar stories. Carlton Fisk told me the same thing, you know, a year or two later. He didn't talk about his hit that he waved fair, his home run in Boston that everybody else would remember. He had a personal favorite that meant more to him because of that same kind of lesson coming up with Boston. And I found that the more I thought, hey, that's pretty cool, I want to ask this guy. So I would ask Mike Schmidt, or I would ask Jim Thome after a Dodger game, or whatever it was. I was curious myself, and it became really a case of collecting hits like people collect trading cards. So Diamonds from the Dugout really evolved over the course of the decade, and this is really my own personal collection that I'm just displaying for other people to enjoy.
Now, you didn't just talk to Hall of Famers. You spoke to people like Felix Mian, Bobby Richardson, which I thought was very interesting. And could you talk about some of those players you spoke to?
Yeah, that made it, I kind of wanted a little unevenness to it. I wasn't trying to get every living Hall of Famer. I do have about 45 Hall of Famers in the book. And, over the course, of a decade, you know, when you're covering baseball, you're around individuals who have great stories to tell. And whether they're a pretty good player, I guess, who had 1,500 hits, or a legend who had 3,000, they've all got great stories. And so I would just gradually compile them, Bill, and kind of, you know, I would transcribe my tape, and I would write a little section on that player and just kind of put it away. And over the course of the year, these grew. And I would find myself like a cutting room floor dropping this guy whose hit was, you know, so mildly interesting, because I just added another player who had a really fascinating story to share that was a really important everyday lesson that can help people. So that's kind of how it grew. And to be honest, people ask, why is it 115 baseball legends? It's because eventually you run across a publisher who buys into it and has the same vision, and that's what happened to me last year. So obviously then, guess what, you have a deadline. So the final manuscript, the final guy to be added, was Alex Rodriguez, when I talked to him this past summer, and he shared his story about that double in the 2009 World Series, Game 4 against Philadelphia, that scored Damon after his dash. You know, for A-Rod, it was a matter of atonement. You know, he was really struggling. People were really on him. He wasn't a clutch guy in the postseason. But that was his moment where he really came alive. Cole Hamels had hit him with a pitch, kind of woke him up. And for A-Rod to be able to pick one from a successful winning moment in his career is what he chose out of 3,000, out of, you know, 600 plus home runs. So it's interesting to find what these guys answer, no matter where they are in their own career.
Right. It was a different answer. It was amazing. And could you talk about Albert Pujols? You also spoke to him, and talk about how amazing that was.
Yeah. Well, one thing I also, you know, observed in compiling these, you know, the younger guys are moving targets. So most of the guys, you know, Brooks Robinson wrote the foreword to the book, and he starts off by saying, you're going to find a lot of my friends in this book. And that's really what it is. It's guys in the 50s, 60s, 40s, if you include Dr. Bobby Brown, 40s, 50s, 60s, yes. 70s, 80s, 90s. And I've got some, there's some active players in it, but you know, when guys are moving targets, you know, you're like, well, are they going to change? Would they change their answer in a month? Albert Pujols, maybe if you asked him right now, he would have said his home run that broke the record for the most, you know, ever by a Latin player, or maybe it would have been a 600th. But when I talked to him, it was his last year with the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. He told me that the hit that mattered the most to him was his home run off Justin Verlander, who was a hot young prospect at that time for Detroit, leading him into the World Series. And for Pujols, it was his first home run in a World Series, and he said, that's what you play for. That's the whole goal of doing this, to do something like that on the grandest stage. And the way he described it, I thought was really cool. So, again, he may now pick an Angels hit. I doubt it, but that's, you know, for the most part, I've got guys who are done with their careers. But, you know, Ed Derek Jeter, similar case. Talked to him in 2009, ALCS, right before Game 6 against the Angels. And his answer, I thought at the time, was kind of dumb. And then the more I thought, hey, it's really awesome. It was a great lesson on preparation, because I said, Derek, what – one hit meant the most to you and why? And he said, the next one you're going to get. So a very Jeter-esque answer. And maybe today he would say his 3,000th hit. Maybe it was the last one at Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. But that's the one I went with.
Diamonds to the Dugout. It's put out by Mark Newman. The publisher is Cardinal Publishers Group. And Mark, one last thing. Do you see a second book similar to this coming out?
Absolutely. It's going to spawn any number of sequels, whether it's the same topic, whether it's just talking to pitchers this time. And by the way, I've got four or five pitchers in the book. I broke my own personal rule, don't include a pitcher, when Jim Palmer and Fergie Jenkins shared their hits. They were too good to leave out. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe something having to do with pitchers. Maybe it's a different sport. Maybe it's more of the same, because I've got a lot more guys to talk to. And, you know, you never know, but there are definitely plans.
Mark Newman, listen, thank you so much for being on the show, and everybody buy this book. It's a great read.
Thanks a lot, Rocket.
Take care.